Physics World.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Physics World Weekly. I'm James Dacey. This week, quite a few of the Physics World team are out and about enjoying their summer holidays. So in a break from our usual format, we've got an extended interview for you. On Monday, I popped up to the University of Bristol to meet the glaciologist, Jonathan Bamber. Jonathan's also the president of the European Geophysical Union, and he's clearly a very active kind of guy, as he counts ultramarathon running and ski mountaineering among his hobbies. We talked about the global impacts of climate change, ice mechanics, and how his undergraduate degree in physics has shaped his approach to academic research. We began, though, by discussing a recent review paper that Jonathan has co-authored in the journal Environmental Research Letters. It looks at the contribution of land ice to sea level rise during the satellite era. Okay, Jonathan, yeah, thanks for joining us for this podcast.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So you've recently published a review paper in Environmental Research Letters, and it's looking at the contribution of melting land ice to sea level rise. Do you want to maybe just summarise what you did and the key findings from that study?
Yeah, sure. So it was a review article, a review article. That means we were synthesising dozens, many dozens of other studies. But on top of that, we also introduced our own analysis, or a component of the review was a new analysis and adding to what people had already done before. So it was kind of a mixture of reviewing what was already out there combined with where we thought the gaps were in observational evidence of land ice contribution to sea level rise. Now, when we talk about land ice, we're talking about three major components, this is how we kind of divide it up. So we've got what are called glaciers and ice caps. Those are mountain glaciers and larger bodies of ice called ice caps that are in mountain areas or high altitude areas primarily, or parts of the Arctic. Glaciers and ice caps are basically everything that isn't the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheet. And those are the two other major components, Antarctica and Greenland. And actually, Antarctica and Greenland contain 99.5% of all of the land ice on the planet. So they're the biggest by volume and the most important for potential future sea level rise. But if you look at the last century, glaciers and ice caps have actually been the dominant contribution of those three to sea level rise. So we were looking at what people had done before in terms of assessing the contribution of all of those components during what's called the satellite era, which is a period really starting, satellites have been up since the 1960s, but the most useful ones for what we're working on have been flying since 1991. So we're really looking at time period, actually end of 91, so 1992 to the present day.
So I know in the study you mentioned that there's a certain degree of uncertainty around the impact that this ice is having on sea level rise. Where do those uncertainties come from? Why is it so difficult to get a real accurate grasp on it?
Well, certainly before we had these satellites flying, it was very difficult, and we had really quite a poor knowledge of what the ice sheets were contributing to sea level. Because, if you take Antarctica, for example, it's a huge continent. It's larger than the conterminous USA. That's basically the whole of America, apart from Alaska. It's more than 5,000 kilometers across. It's vast, and it's a very, very difficult place to make field observations or to do anything on the ground. So if you really want a comprehensive picture or understanding of what the ice sheet, the whole of Antarctica, is doing, the only reliable and accurate way of doing that is from space. And we have only had useful observations from space to be able to do that since the early 90s. So that's one of the major factors. And the other thing is that the signals we're looking for, the change in volume of the ice sheets, are quite small compared to the huge area that you're dealing with. So it's what we'd call a signal-to-noise problem. Mm-hmm. You know, the signal is tiny and there's quite a lot of noise. So it makes measuring those changes quite challenging. We're talking about trying to get accuracies of, let's say, on the order of a centimetre a year of change in surface elevation over this huge continent that's incredibly remote.
So using these space-based techniques, you're talking about satellites, are you referring to imagery or radar? What sort of techniques are involved?
Well, there are a range of different techniques we can use, actually, but the ones, or the approach that goes furthest back in time, is called satellite radar altimetry, and that's measures, it sends microwave pulses down to the ground from a satellite that's orbiting at, let's say, 1500 kilometers above the surface of the Earth, and it measures the time delay of that pulse of microwave energy that bounces off the surface of the Earth and goes back to the satellite. And it needs to measure that the time delay with an accuracy of nanoseconds, because you're trying to get, you know, millimeter or centimeter accuracy. So it's incredible technology. And actually, these altimeters were originally and primarily designed for measuring changes in sea surface height, so sea level. And they're still used for that, but it turns out that actually over the relatively flat interior of the ice sheets, Antarctica and Greenland, they're quite good for measuring surface elevation change. And so we use those to measure the change in volume of the ice sheets over time. But and that's not imagery, it's literally pulses of microwave energy that you then have to process. And it gives you elevation change through time. But there are other approaches that we can use which do involve imagery, mainly radar imagery, but various other techniques. One of the most interesting, and it's really revolutionized a lot of what we can do in terms of understanding exchange of mass between land and the ocean, so not just ice but land hydrology as well, is from two nearly identical satellites called GRACE, that's the Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment. Now, that they were launched in end of 2002 and are no longer operating, but a GRACE follow-on mission was launched earlier this year. And they measure changes in the gravity field of the Earth, and those changes are related to mass going from the land into the ocean or the other way around. Mm.
So I think, because you mentioned in the paper, the length scale of that is of the order, is it 300 kilometres?
Yeah.
So how do you kind of integrate those measurements with the radar, the altimetry?
Okay.
How does that work?
So because satellites that are measuring changes in the gravity field is what's called a geopotential field. You know, it's measuring a potential, and it's a very smooth, long wavelength observation that's being made, so yeah, approximate resolution of a few hundred kilometers. So you can't, for example, determine what an individual glacier is doing, or even a small catchment. But you can deduce, for example, what the whole ice sheet is doing, or major basins on an ice sheet like Greenland or Antarctica, and depending on the area and how big the signal is, you can use the gravity data to give you an indication of mass loss from whole mountain ranges, for example, like the whole of the Canadian Arctic or something like that.
So it sounds like you've done, you know, a hell of a lot of work synthesizing all these different techniques and measurement length scales. And what did you find? I mean, what were the key findings compared to what we knew before the study?
Well, we knew something about all of these components. We had some estimates of glaciers and ice caps. We had some estimates of the ice sheets. I think that the kind of headline result that we got, which I wouldn't say is entirely surprising, but certainly the accuracy and the putting everything together made it the picture much clearer than before, is that certainly since the start of the early 90s, the sea level contribution from glaciers and ice sheets was relatively modest. It was quite small. And actually, the early 90s, it was it was probably anomalously low because of something called Mount Pinatubo. Now, Mount Pinatubo was a large volcanic eruption that took place in 1991 and resulted in global cooling of about 1 degree for about a year or more. And that's because it spewed all these sulfate aerosols into the atmosphere, which reflected lots of solar radiation. So if you cool the planet, then ice doesn't melt so quickly. That's fairly obvious. So we think that in the early 90s, the amount of, or the contribution to sea level rise was modest for an unusual reason, which is this volcanic eruption. But if you plot the trend from then to 2016, so 25-year period, you see a pretty much steady increase in mass loss from all components of land ice, so glaciers and ice caps and the ice sheets, so that now they are contributing a little under 2 millimeters a year to sea level rise, and the total sea level rise at the minute is about just over 3 millimeters a year. So they are the dominant contribution.
So is the other contribution, is it the thermal expansion?
That's right.
As the earth warms up.
Yeah, I mean, there are various factors. So there is also land hydrology, that's changes in precipitation over land surfaces, and also human-induced impacts like building dams or irrigation or water extraction. That's rather small in comparison. The two big effects on sea level are melting of ice and thermal expansion. And during the 20th century, our best estimates are that those two factors were roughly equal. And there's some uncertainty, or if you like, debate about what the rate of sea level rise was during the 20th century. But it was somewhere between 1.1 and 1.7 millimeters a year. So if we sort of choose a number roughly somewhere in the middle of that, you know, we're talking about 15 centimeters roughly over the 20th century of sea level rise. During the late 20th century, so since the 1990s to now, the rate of sea level rise has been roughly double that, nearer 3.2 millimeters a year. And it's been from both effects, both increased thermal expansion because the oceans are warming, and increased melting from glaciers, and in particular from the Greenland ice sheet. And that's what our results absolutely very, very clearly show.
I mean, I think the physicists in listening to this might be quite interested in the mechanics of how these ice sheets actually melt. And I know in the paper you have a sort of cross-section of the different sheets as they move the ocean, and you spoke about these mass balance calculations.
Right.
So what are the points where it's melting and the points where maybe it's growing?
So there are a number of different processes that influence the growth or decay of an ice mass. And it depends whether it's what's called marine terminating or land terminating. What that means is, does the edge of this ice mass, so particularly in Antarctica, are the margins in contact with the ocean? And that's so you have these marine terminating outlets that if there's a change in ocean temperature, they can erode the ice from beneath, from the underneath where they're in contact with the ice. If it's land terminating, then the ocean has no effect at all. But for marine terminating margins, that's almost all of Antarctica and a very significant proportion of Greenland. There are two processes by which you can lose mass. One is by ice discharge across what's called the grounding line. That's the point at which the ice leaves the bedrock and starts floating on the ocean. So you've got ice flowing from the interior of the continent, or the island in case of Greenland, out towards the ocean, and it basically flows off the land into the ocean. And once it's in the ocean, it's lost. It's contributing to sea level rise. The other key process, which is not really important in Antarctica, but is very important in Greenland, is surface melting. At the surface of the ice sheet or glacier, and obviously that's related to well, what we call the energy balance, how much and what controls the energy balance. Well, like surface air temperature is important, but radiation, solar radiation is really key for controlling how much heat is absorbed at the surface and how much surface melting takes place.
Yeah, in terms of the other side of the equation, the growth, I mean, is there any scenario where a warming planet would actually lead to more precipitation and more growth?
Yeah, absolutely. I should say we haven't really observed that yet. There is some evidence that in the interior of Greenland, where you don't have all this melting taking place because it's higher elevation and it's much colder and you don't get so much melting, that there has been a modest increase in snowfall in recent decades associated with the warming. So you absolutely do expect that. It's a Clausius-Clapeyron equation, so which is, you know, if you warm the atmosphere and it can contain more moisture, and it's as simple as that. So in a warmer climate, you do expect more precipitation and more snowfall. And the climate models, when you run them forward in time, you do see that there is more precipitation over Antarctica, because that's very cold, and there's minimum melting there, and so it is possible that we could get more snowfall over Antarctica, which could partly compensate for other processes taking mm-hmm. place, you know, increased mass loss. But we don't think it will entirely compensate for it. But I should say that the observations so far haven't actually shown that happening in Antarctica yet.
Okay, I mean, it goes without saying that, you know, rising sea level is, you know, poses a threat to the planet. But which regions do you think are most vulnerable? You know, which are you most concerned about in a scenario where we see significant sea level rise?
All the low-lying coastal areas around the world, and so it's places like Bangladesh, the Netherlands, the Nile Delta, and many what are called coastal megacities. So that's London is one of them, San Francisco, I think Mumbai, Mexico City, there are, you know, New York, you know, many major conurbations with populations in excess of 8 million people are in coastal areas that would be at risk from rising sea level.
And you think you mentioned there's a future, well, sorry, not a future, but a follow-on GRACE, which is already in place. And is it the
GFO, GRACE follow-on mission.
GRACE follow-on, sorry. And there's the ISAT-2 mission as well.
Exactly.
So how will these new satellites, how will they help you to further refine these observations?
So ISAT-2 is the successor to a laser altimeter, which is a little bit different from the radar altimeter that I mentioned before. It's the same principle, but instead of using microwave energy, it's using laser light and pulses of laser light, and you measure the time delay. Now, if ISAT-2 is meant to be launched, I think, in September, and if that's successful, I think with ISAT-2 and GRACE follow-on combined, we really will have incredibly powerful observation capability for measuring and understanding what the contribution to sea level rise is from land ice. And unprecedented, actually. Mm-hmm. It'll be really fantastic. And I think we'll be able to reduce the uncertainties even more going forward in time.
And what's the timeline? I know we had the fifth assessment from the IPCC. When is the next one, do you?
AR6, the sixth assessment report, I think it's due in 2021, is it? Or is it 2020? But it's being worked on now. They have the writing teams together, and I think they've just had the first lead authors meeting in China, I believe. So that's in process. And I mean, the work that we're doing as part of our European Research Council funded project called Global Mass, that will all contribute to the AR6. But before the AR6 comes out, there is what's called a special report on oceans and cryosphere, called the SROC, which is also an IPCC report, and I believe that's going to be published next year.
And what is, you sort of alluded to it there, but the process of bringing together these reports, I mean, to somebody who perhaps isn't familiar with the field, so it's obviously the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. How is that run? How is that managed? And how does all this research feed into this final document?
Well, it's a huge... I mean, the IPCC reports are a huge undertaking. In fact, there's one on my desk there, and it's, what, I don't know, about 1,400 pages long or something. And a huge amount of work goes into it. There are thousands, literally thousands of authors that contributing and lead authors that that contribute directly to the writing of the reports. But they are designed to be a synthesis of the state of knowledge, the state of understanding at that time in terms of all parts of the climate system. So there'll be not just sea level, but, you know, the atmosphere and near-term climate impacts, long-term climate impacts, and stuff on past climate variability. And so many different components, and it's the most authoritative sort of document on how the climate reacts to changes in forcing.
So yes, it's obviously a very interdisciplinary project, and you're working now, you're based in the Department of Geography here at the University of Bristol, but you had a background in physics, I understand. So how
did you... Yeah, I've still got a background in physics. Course, yeah, so yeah. I did a physics degree in Bristol many years ago, and I think what appealed to... I mean, you know, it's a funny path that I took, because what appealed to me about physics was, as a child, was astronomy, actually. And I think it's probably true of a lot of people, you know. Used to love astronomy as a kid, and I've still got a 4-foot Newtonian reflector actually in my garage, which I don't use very often anymore, I have to say. And I did a physics degree, and I was always interested in the natural environment and, you know, the sort of health of the planet, if you like, and that kind of thing. And interestingly, I think this is sort of mildly amusing, but... there is a very well-known physical oceanographer who works at UEA, who's in the same year as me. We had the same third-year supervisor, and she has also gone into natural sciences and you know, if you like, geosciences. She does polar oceanography. I did a physics degree, and then my PhD was broadly geophysics, glaciology, at a place called Scott Polar Research Institute in Cambridge. And then actually I moved to the Department of Space and Climate Physics at UCL, University College London. And there, I mean, most of the people there actually were astronomers, but we were in a relatively small group doing Earth observation. That's kind of using the same technology as the astronomers use, but looking down at our own planet. And I think, yeah, it's just developed from that, really.
Well, I suppose, I mean, the thing you're doing now, it's... It obviously does use physics as physics principles, it's geophysics, but it's a long way from kind of quantum physics, that sort of thing. I mean, how does your background, your undergraduate degree in physics, how does that influence the way you think and the way you approach a scientific problem?
Well, I have to say, I haven't used much of the special relativity or the general relativity that I learned as an undergraduate in my later career, but actually other stuff has been fundamental. So the statistical physics, all the thermal physics, and of course EM, electromagnetism, is sort of what is basically the tools and bread and butter of what I do now. And I think what I particularly liked about the physics degree that I did, and it's probably true of most, is that I think it sets you up to be able to, you have a very analytical approach. You have reasonably good basis in maths and numerical analysis, you know, you have a pretty good understanding about many principles of how the world works, in terms of the physical principles, and so you can apply that to such a wide range of different problems. Most of my colleagues working in climate science are physicists.
And what were the... I presume there were challenges as well along the way, and, you know, to learn this new language about environmental science. I mean, was that a challenge, or for you, was it completely natural to glide into that?
It's not the sort of thing that happened overnight. I mean, I've been working in the field for, I don't know, 35 years or so, and I think one of the things that's nice about being an academic is actually you are constantly learning. Every day you're learning something new, and understanding something you didn't know before. So I wouldn't say it's a journey which I've not completed yet. Mm-hmm. And I didn't find it particularly difficult, actually. I mean, my focus as a geoscientist has been mainly glaciology, so studying of ice. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where most of my research has been.
And would you recommend this to, you know, somebody perhaps listen to this who's an undergraduate physicist or a related discipline that isn't directly working in the environment? Would you recommend it as a career?
So I've had almost 30 postdocs that I've supervised over my career, and around about 20 PhD students. That's let's say around about 50 people who have considered a career in this field, in glaciology, in geosciences. Most of those probably with a physics background, and then perhaps 2/3 physics, 1/3 geography, something like that, roughly. Mm-hmm. And of those, I would say about 2/3 have moved out of academia into a whole range of other disciplines. So everything from things like freelance science journalism, I had one really bright PhD student who went straight into banking, you know. But quite a lot of them move into applied aspects of the same problem. So one PhD student went to work for the Met Office. Another one went to work for an environmental consultancy and to the Environment Agency, and similar sorts of applied areas of geoscience.
Obviously, you know, you spoke in about the study earlier and the different techniques that are involved. So presumably a lot of this research does involve going out into the field, going to these quite extreme locations. How much of a part of research is that really for most people?
So fieldwork in my discipline, so glaciology and geoscience in general, fieldwork is an essential part of understanding how the system you're interested in works, but it's not something I do a lot of personally. My colleagues in the Bristol Glaciology Centre, where I'm based, many of them do fieldwork every year. You know, they'll go to either Greenland, Antarctica, or Svalbard, which is in the high Arctic. At least once a year. I've got a PhD student who's just coming back from Greenland, and another one who is out there right now, actually, a postdoc who's out there. But I don't tend to do so much myself, but it's an essential part of. So there are certain things you can do from space. It gives you the synoptic global coverage, but often your satellite doesn't measure the exact quantity that you're interested in. It measures some proxy, some kind of indirect estimate of it. And so you have to have these field observations to make sure that what the satellite is measuring genuinely relates to the thing you're interested in. And so, yeah, it's an essential part of our understanding of the system.
I noticed as well on your Twitter profiles, assuming it was you, that you are also interested in ultramarathon running and mountaineering. So do you think, does that kind of come from the same place, this interest in the outdoors?
And... Yeah, natural environment. I love the natural environment. I love being in it. You know, I live in Bristol, but I go to the Brecons and the Black Mountains, which are the sort of the closest hills that we have to around this part of the UK. And I just love. Actually, they are brilliant if you're interested in glacial geomorphology, because they're classic glacial landscapes, Breckens in particular. You can see exactly where the glaciers used to flow, I've always enjoyed being in natural environment and exploring it, and I think my career has absolutely related to that. It's a more formal way of exploring how the world works, isn't it, really?
Thanks for listening today. Jonathan's paper about land ice and sea level rise is available in Environmental Research Letters. It's an open access journal produced by IOP Publishing, which also produces Physics World. We'll post a link to the article on the audio pages of the Physics World website. We'll be back next week when you can find out about the amazing world of ultrasound as I catch up with Bruce Drinkwater, an engineer also at the University of Bristol. Until then, have a good week.
Physics World.